Beginning tomorrow, all students at both public and private schools across the state will be staying home in an effort to stop the spread of the coronavirus. Universities and colleges in Illinois have also postponed in-person classes. We'll hear how educators are handling the transition to virtual learning. And researchers who study sleep say teens aren't getting enough of it and say schools can do more to help by having class start later. We'll revisit our conversation with a sleep scientist and an Illinois school district that's moved to later start times.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up next on the 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Reginald Hardwick. As of this morning, there are nearly 100 COVID-19 cases in Illinois, and over the weekend, we saw the first cases announced in the central part of our state. Governor J.B. Pritzker has ordered all bars and restaurants closed to dine-in patrons starting tonight until March 30th. Also closed all K-12 schools in the state to avoid the spread of the coronavirus. Here's what the governor had to say on Friday.
I'm speaking in the very literal sense when I say that having the general public stay home one day at a time will have a massive effect on bending this curve, and that means lives saved.
In a little bit, we'll hear how school districts and colleges plan to handle virtual learning until classrooms reopen and get reactions from parents and teachers. But first, just as students were packing up to leave campus for spring break, many received instructions not to come back. There's been a stream of university announcements around Illinois suspending in-person classes, closing residence halls, and canceling events. For more on this, we're joined now by WILL's Illinois Newsroom reporter, Lee Gaines. Lee has also been reporting on Illinois students returning from abroad and some of the challenges they faced. Lee, welcome back to the 21st.
Glad to be here.
We're also joined by Kate Grossman, senior editor for the Education Desk at WBEZ in Chicago. Kate, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Lee, first, can you give us an update on what instructions students have been given from the University of Illinois system?
So the big thing is migrating classes online. So this is actually the university's spring break week starting today. But face-to-face classes have been canceled beginning March 23rd, which was when students were supposed to return from spring break. The campus here in Urbana is not closed, and the residence halls will remain open. But the university is kind of encouraging students to go home if they can. And it's also encouraging as many staff to work from home as possible. I think it's worth pointing out to our listeners that many NPR member stations across the country are affiliated with universities, including WILL. So as such, I'm actually a University of Illinois employee, and I am also working from home today for, at least the next few weeks. So as far as students are concerned, they are being encouraged to stay in their residence halls if they don't have reliable internet access at home. And then also events of more than 50 people are suspended indefinitely, and all university-sponsored international travel is prohibited, along with non-essential domestic travel. I think it's also worth noting that Champaign County just had its first confirmed case of COVID-19. The U of I did send out an email saying that the person who is sick has no known connections to the university. As far as University of Illinois at Springfield is concerned, they're essentially doing the same thing as Urbana. They're trying to get as many employees and students to continue their lives remotely. The campus will remain open, however, and the University of Illinois at Chicago is extending their spring break, which starts today through March 30th, and classes there will resume online as well.
Kate, I understand you know what the other universities and parts of the state are doing. What's going on there?
Well, in the Chicago area, like in the rest of the state and really the rest of the country, they're doing similar to what U of I is. They're extending their spring break or just planning after spring break to move to, you know, remote learning, e-learning. Couple schools, University of Chicago and DePaul, just called off their whole spring quarter. Just made that call ahead of time. You know, some places, I guess, like Illinois State says that students will be out until April 12th. But, you know, there's a good chance a lot of students won't come back at all for the rest of this year. So a lot of scrambling by professors. We had Kate McGee, our higher ed reporter, had a story that ran on Friday about professors and kind of making this transition, because there's a big difference between, you know, of course, most professors are computer literate, but they is a big difference between, you know, putting assignments online and maybe, you know, posting videos or something for students to watch versus, you know, running a whole course online. So that's, I think a lot of professors are using this time over spring break to get up to speed on how to actually do that, because, you know, a lot of them don't know how.
Lee, do you know why the University of Illinois system made this decision when they did?
Well, I think they were following suit with what a lot of universities across the country are doing, as Kate just mentioned. You know, this isn't unique to Illinois. It's not unique to the University of Illinois at Urbana. This is something that universities across the country are making calls on. And I think that a lot of the universities in the state, not just this one, are in close communication with the Illinois Department of Public Health and also their respective county public departments or departments of public health. And I think that they are making some of these decisions in consultation with them. I mean, the biggest thing that these universities are really urging right now is social distancing. And part of social distancing is not holding in-person classes, encouraging their employees to work from home, because the further that we are away from one another, the less likely we are to pass this virus between each other.
And Lee, as you mentioned earlier, you know, I'm sitting here in the WILL studios. You're working from home because we want that physical, like they say, social distancing to prevent any passing of the coronavirus or COVID-19, even if people don't have it. Kate, are there other concerns that you've heard from either parents, professors, students, or universities about embracing social distancing measures?
I mean, I think in general, people are trying to be supportive of it. I think it's really hard for college students, quite frankly, to deal with this. I mean, the big brouhaha in Chicago here over the weekend was that there were, I'm sure this included some college students, there were a lot of people out Saturday night celebrating an early St. Patrick's Day. And that's really, I think, one of the main prompts for the governor to make the call to order all bars and restaurants closed for, you know, in-person dining. You know, you can still do takeout, drive-through, but I think all the partying that went on this weekend was a major factor in the decision to close down bars and restaurants. And so it's going to be really interesting what happens over the next couple of weeks to see whether students who are home, whether they're able to stay in their homes and not socialize a lot. And, you know, because the big issue is that younger people tend to, from what I understand from public health officials, the younger people that are getting COVID-19 don't usually have severe symptoms, but they can then infect other people who are more vulnerable. And so that's a big area of caution.
Lee, of course, it's not just students who have been living on campus that have been affected, but also students who were studying abroad when this outbreak really started to spread. You spoke with some University of Illinois students who have been abroad in Italy, and the school ordered them to come home. And you spoke with one student named Alyssa. Here's what she had to say.
The email they sent was kind of vague, and nothing else was really provided. Nothing about what would happen to our academics, what parts of our program would be refunded to us. The main point of that email was just, we want all students out of Italy right now.
Lee, I understand there were some eye-opening things that happened or didn't happen when she got home. What exactly happened?
Yeah, I was really surprised reporting this story about what happened to the students who had been ordered to come home. I think one of the big things I was surprised about was you know, when she got home, she didn't know how to self-quarantine. You know, that's something she had studied or researched before. That's something that her parents and her had to kind of figure out on their own. I know her parents used guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, but she didn't have any contact with her local public health department. And this is a student who is currently still in quarantine in the Bay Area of California right now. And so her health department doesn't know, as far as I know, unless she's reached out to them since we reported this story, that there's someone who just returned from a country that's been severely affected by the virus trying to self-quarantine. And I know that that was really concerning to our public health officials here in Champaign County.
Right. Italy has seen even over the weekend, we saw very severe increase in the number of cases and even deaths over the weekend. We have another clip of a student named Joe who came back from studying abroad in Italy to the suburbs of Chicago. Here's what he said.
And then when we flew from Warsaw to Chicago, I was in and out of customs in like 5 minutes. It was almost as if nothing was happening.
Joe's situation would have been different had he flown back more recently. We saw all the crowds at O'Hare over the weekend. But when he flew back from Italy a few weeks ago, cases there had spiked, so he wasn't screened because he flew from Warsaw to O'Hare.
Yeah, Joe has a really interesting situation. He had flown from Italy to Poland right before the university ordered everyone to come back who was studying abroad in Italy. And when he flew from Italy to Poland, he said that people came on the plane in these protective suits and took everyone's temperature. So I was really surprised when I talked to him that when he flew from Warsaw back to Chicago after he had been ordered to return home or to at least leave his study abroad program, that there was really no screening being done. And he said, you know, he was asked where he had been. He mentioned Italy, and it was like he had come from any other country that wasn't affected. So that was really interesting to me. And you know, for the record, Alyssa had the same experience, and she flew directly from Milan to San Francisco. There was really nothing, you know, no screening happening. She said it was the normal process as she was accustomed to it. And, you know, she felt like she could have, if she had wanted to, gotten back on a plane and gone straight back to Italy and no questions asked.
Kate, we know.
You know, I think things are starting to change because we had a student, we did a story about a student who arrived home to O'Hare on Saturday afternoon, and he was in that crush, in the big crowds waiting at customs at O'Hare. But he did say that they took his temperature. He got a CDC packet about, you know, how to protect yourself and information about, I think there was information about quarantine. I'm actually not 100% sure, but he did get information from the CDC and had his temperature checked before he was able to leave the airport. So it sounds like maybe those things are starting to change, and he came from Spain.
Yeah, definitely. I think the situation is just so fluid right now that, you know, these students returning in early March, it was just a totally different situation for them. And at that point, I think the university hadn't even made the call yet to cancel its face-to-face classes.
Kate, you were there in Chicago over the weekend, and I mean, those lines were just incredible at O'Hare Airport.
Yeah, so this student, his name's Rafi Derringer, and he said, you know, this is exactly what you were not supposed to do, right? Stand shoulder to shoulder with a bunch of other people for hours on end. You know, this is how you get COVID-19, not how you avoid getting it. Now, there was a huge uproar in Chicago, and the governor tweeted to the president, and then the vice president called him, and after he tweeted and went on Meet the Press on Sunday morning to say they were going to double the number of customs screeners, and then the city jumped in and got EMTs to work as screeners. So it sounds like by last night we had a reporter out at the airport on Sunday night, and things were going very smoothly, actually.
Lee, has there been any response from the University of Illinois to your story?
Not really, but I mean, I also don't totally blame them. I think that the university, as well as K-12 schools right now, are kind of slammed figuring out, like, how to manage this crisis that is, You know, as Kate mentioned, things are changing really quickly. So even if, you know, Joe and Alyssa came back and it was like nothing was happening, now those people that are coming from Europe are going through, like, you know, these massive 100-long people lines, and with CDC trying to check everyone's temperature. So it's definitely a quick-changing story. One thing that I do think is interesting, or one piece of advice I will say, that I was given by the Champaign County Health Department administrator for these students, is just to, you know, tell them that if you are self-quarantining, try to make contact with your local health department, because a lot of these students didn't come back to Champaign-Urbana. They came back to wherever their families live, and that's all across the country. So try to make contact with those health departments. But also, you know, she said that probably a lot of those health departments are pretty overwhelmed right now.
And Lee, for the students who are coming back to campuses, do you know if residence halls are open for them?
Yes, so residence halls are open. They're being encouraged to come back if they don't have access to internet at their families' homes. But I think if they can go home, I think the university would prefer for them to go stay with their families, just to keep that social distancing in play. I don't think they want a lot of students like congregating together on campus. That's, again, how diseases get spread.
And that's for the University of Illinois. We also know that, however, at Illinois State, they have said, quote, accommodations for students who cannot return home will be addressed on a case-by-case basis based on university housing services. Well, we've been speaking with Lee Gaines, education reporter for WILL and the Illinois Newsroom, about how universities are mandating that people practice what health officials call social distancing to stop the spread of the coronavirus. Lee is going to stick around for our next segment. We've also been speaking with Kate Grossman, senior education editor at WBEZ. Thank you, Kate, for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Coming up, with schools closing, students will have to learn from home. We'll talk about some of the unique challenges this presents for educators and parents. I'm Reginald Hardwick. You're listening to the 21st. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Today, we're taking a closer look at how the coronavirus is affecting the education system in our state. Governor Pritzker announced Friday that schools will temporarily close for in-person classes beginning tomorrow in an effort to slow the speed of the virus. About 2.2 million students in Illinois will be staying home, and teachers were given the weekend to prepare virtual lessons for the next 2 weeks. Illinois colleges and universities will also postpone in-person classes and take their lectures online after the break. Ben Leroy teaches a law course at the University of Illinois. He joins us now to tell us about how he's preparing to shift his course to online for at least a few weeks. We're also joined by James Lowe. He's experienced in developing online courses. He serves as director of the College of Veterinary Medicine's iLearning Center at the University of Illinois. Ben and James, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Also on the line, Lee Gaines. She is with us. She is the education reporter for WILL's Illinois Newsroom, and she's right here in Urbana with me. However, she's staying at home. We're practicing social distancing here on the 21st. Also, Peter Medlin is with us from our partner station, WNIJ in DeKalb, where he is the education reporter. Peter and Lee, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks.
Glad to be here.
Lee, I'll start with you. How are schools in Central Illinois preparing to go virtual? Were they given any instructions or recommendations from the State Board of Education?
So the State Board has come out and said that this forced closure of schools, these e-learning days, if you want to call them that, will not count as instructional days on the school calendar. So they haven't had to have their regional offices of education approve their e-learning plans, and that school districts have full autonomy to provide continuous learning opportunities through whatever means they see fit. That includes online. I know some schools in this area are also handing out paper packets to families. So they're basically just encouraging school districts to do whatever works best for them. And I should note that a lot of schools in the Champaign-Urbana area, this is their spring break this week. So I know that teachers and school administrators here are taking that time to figure out what to do. They're really scrambling to get together online resources and also paper packets for families to use while at home with their kids between now and March 30th. Champaign Unit 4 schools, again, they're taking this week to develop those resources. And I did speak with a superintendent in Rantoul a few weeks ago who was really concerned about getting e-learning resources to students because many of the students in that area lack internet access in their homes. So I do think that this could become a situation where students with internet access get very different learning opportunities than those without. Also, I think it's worth pointing out that these days are counted by the state as Act of God days, meaning they will not need to be made up at the end of the school year.
How is the school situation changing you? Let us know. Tweet us at 21st Show. That's our handle, at 21st Show. Peter, you spoke with a rural district that recently received their e-learning plan approved. What can you tell us about the district and what do they plan to do?
Yeah, I talked to the superintendent at Amboy, which is about 690 kids or so, and I actually talked to him on Thursday afternoon when the statewide closures didn't seem quite as imminent, which seems like a year ago now. But yeah, so they were also really concerned with internet access, and they are one to one. They do send Chromebooks back at home, so they were using those for Google Classroom, those types of things. But especially for younger kids like elementary kids, that's going to be a lot more paper-based learning packets, sending textbooks home, that sort of thing. And I haven't talked to him since then, but I know that the state board right now is recommending that with schools that do use those take-home packets that kind of make those available at the same locations that they're doing meal drop-offs and things like that.
I understand this district that you covered, it's huge.
Yes. Yeah. He said that it's a lot of square miles. It's rural. So it's a really, really wide space. So internet access can be a little bit spotty. People can have satellite internet, or he said that there's a lot of situations where people, not a lot, but there are situations where people say that they have internet access, but what they really mean is they have a cell phone plan. So it can be definitely spotty.
Ben Leroy, you teach law at the University of Illinois. I want to bring you into the conversation. The U of I announced last week that classes after spring break would be virtual. What did you hear from students? I understand you were in class with them when the official email came.
I was in class. So I teach my current class, Land Use Planning, on Wednesday evenings. And I began my class with a discussion of the fact that we would likely be moving online. And so I was fortunate to have the opportunity to speak in person with my class about what online platforms they have had good experiences or bad experiences with, because we're not being tracked into a particular online platform. It's up to the instructor to choose, what streaming service we use. I also got a chance to talk with my students about what sort of format they would like to see, because we have a very discussion-oriented class. I teach 17 students, and we have a great dialogue that helps us all learn together. And I know that that's going to be impossible to perfectly replicate, and so we wanted to discuss some strategies together. The announcement came in the middle of class, and one of my students said, "Oh, we just got an email from the university," and I'll say, we are optimistic that we're going to do well together, but I think not just myself, but most of my students really value that in-class learning experience, and so I think there's definitely trepidation. Concern, but optimism and a sense of, we'll all get through it together.
James Lowe, you are director of the Veterinary College's iLearning Center. If someone is shifting a course that is normally in person to online, what are some things they should keep in mind?
Yeah, I think the challenge is, right, and we're obviously all in a time crunch and going to do some things that are probably a bit crazy here over the next few weeks, but from a methods or pedagogy standpoint, online is really different than in class. And obviously, as an instructor, I can't see my students. I can't interact. I don't get immediate feedback do they understand what I'm saying? Do they not? So you have to develop some other tools to create that assessment. And that can be really powerful. It can be really good. As we think about online delivery or online course development, you know, we've kind of gotten stuck in this 50-minute mode of life and education, right? We lecture for 50 minutes, and even in grade school and high school, right, we teach for some period of time, then we leave. And that certainly is not really, we don't have to conform to that in online, and that becomes critical. So we think about how do we build shorter lectures that are really kind of key topics. So maybe 50 minutes is 2 or 3 8 to 10 minute lectures, with focusing on the big points. How do I create a structure for them as learners to think about the material I'm trying to teach them? And then how do I provide the supplemental materials around that for them to go get details? So instead of me standing in front of a room and being the all-knowing educator and spewing all the facts, I'm now trying to give them a framework and a short bit and one idea at a time in a lecture, and then give them supplemental materials to learn that, and then build some assessment back around that time so that there's some short-term feedback. Did they understand the material? Do I know they did it? Do I know what they've learned and what they haven't learned? And it's that bit in the analytics on the back end that are really, really powerful from an online education standpoint. But that material takes time to develop. So certainly we're going to do some things that are pedagogically or methods right, probably not right in the short term, but we certainly hope that this is a boon for all of us to really learn how to innovate a bit better and how do we teach differently and more effectively.
We're talking about schools going online in the wake of the coronavirus spreading across Illinois. I want to read a Twitter comment that the 21st received. Nikki teaches at Southwestern Illinois College. She says, quote, "I use tech in the classroom and believe students will know how to use it outside of the classroom. But I am concerned about their access from home and their ability to commit to assignments with everything else that is going on while class feels less tangible." End quote. Ben, what are you concerned? Are you also concerned about that?
Yeah, you know, I have my own personal concerns about my teaching, and then I have concerns about my students being able to engage with the class. I think to start with the students, I absolutely relate to the concern about students, A, just having the mental capacity to focus on class, given that they may be worried about their own health, the health of their family, what are other logistical issues they're running into. So I recognize that class may take a backseat to some of those more essential things. I also, when I discussed in person with my students, several of them raised concerns about their ability to find a consistent space at our normal meeting time, especially because some of them are going home to other time zones, where they have consistent Wi-Fi, a consistently quiet space, et cetera. So I will be recording the lectures, but we'll have, you know, fewer in-person, people in class while during the live broadcast. And then personally, you know, I, of course, have my own concerns. I've got, I'm concerned about my parents. I'm concerned about my infant daughter, my wife, you know, all my friends, figuring out how to run my household. And then also, you know, I've never taught online before. I've taught both undergrads and graduates. I've taught in the College of Law. I've taught in the Department of Urban and Regional Planning. But I've never taught online. And so I recognize that probably for the rest of the semester, this is going to be more of a workload than just delivering my standard lectures, because I recognize that not only do I need to shift online in this first week after break, but I'll probably need to continue to make shifts as I feel out, what am I doing right? What am I doing wrong? So it's going to be a challenge for the rest of the semester, absolutely.
Lee, we've been talking about colleges. Let's go all the way back to younger people. We know that daycares will remain open, but I imagine a lot of parents could be concerned that they can't stay home with their kids if their jobs don't allow them to work remotely. Are there options for them offered through school districts?
Yeah, this is a big question that I have. I'm really interested to see how this will play out. But I will say in the statement that that's the Illinois State Board of Education released last Friday after the governor made his announcement about K-12 schools. That statement said that they were asking at least one administrator of these schools to stay on site during the regular hours of the school day during this mandated closure period in case children whose parents cannot be home or children experiencing homelessness need a safe place to go. They're also encouraging that teachers and administrators exercise social distancing in all situations and that they conduct outreach to families concerning students who may be at an elevated risk due to the statewide school closures. So this is not, you know, like, I'm really curious how this is actually going to play out in practice. I'm wondering how schools will handle this. And I'm also wondering, you know, how parents will even be aware that this is an option for them.
James, what are some of the downsides to virtual learning that you're concerned about?
Well, I can't even imagine trying to teach second graders with virtual learning. So, right, there's some maturity level and the ability to concentrate and focus. And I think we talked about this, right? How do we restructure the day for the student, because we kind of force them into a schedule now. And one of the things with online is, right, there's less schedule. You can do whatever you want in many respects, because I don't know if you turned up to class or not, or there's less forcing people to turn up to class. So I think that's a real concern. I think the other concern is that online is really good at, and we talk about educating, we think about Bloom's taxonomy, and the bottom of that would be remember, and maybe apply a little bit, but the top of that is how do I create new knowledge, or how do I really do the thing? So Ben in the law school, us here with graduate students, right, we're trying to teach at the top of Bloom's taxonomy and not at the bottom of just, hey, here's some facts and remember them. And online is really, really good at the bottom end of Bloom's taxonomy, the remember. It's not as good at the top because it's got less interaction. And so the creative things, the skill things, learning how to argue as a lawyer, learning how to do surgery as a doctor, those things don't work on online. So we certainly have got a scope. It's not great for everything. But certainly for kind of the mass education thing, the foundational stuff, online is great. And then finally, I can't emphasize enough, particularly as we're thinking about rural school districts, people living in rural areas, rural connectivity, and even sometimes connectivity in some of the city areas, just isn't as good as what it needs to be yet to let us really leverage the online space. And so we do a lot of work with farmers and with in rural communities, and you know the connectivity there is not good. And so I think those are some of the other barriers, right? We think about, sure, if I live in the city of Chicago, I probably have got good access to good internet, and we do here in town, but well, you get outside of town, you get outside of, you know, I live in Mahomet, west of Champaign here. We're great, but our neighbors and other faculty I know that live 3 or 4 miles from us are just in spots where the internet is just as terrible. So we've still got some gaps. We've got to close some of those things as well.
Peter, we've got about a minute left. I know you're in the northern area, and there are just some huge rural school districts, some larger than cities like Philadelphia or Denver in square mileage. What do you know of any resources to help, or what are school districts recommending for those areas with, you know, lack of reliable internet?
Yeah, I think a lot of it, what we're talking about, is they're going to have to rely a lot on those paper and pencil learning packets. And I think I just talked to a regional superintendent for Kane County, and that's even less rural, but they were talking about how there are some districts that aren't one-to-one that are going to have to focus more on that too. And so, yeah, I mean, they're going to have to, it's going to be a lot that, but luckily they've had some time. A lot of these districts have had a little bit more time to think about how they want to have these e-learning since it about a year they've been thinking about planning what these are actually going to look like. So they've had some time to maybe make it, tailor it, or make sure it's able to be, you know, for some students that have special needs, try to accommodate for people that have IEPs. I know some school districts now, you know, trying to do IEP meetings over the phone and things like that. So hopefully some schools have had time to take some time, look at these e-learning plans, and make sure they can accommodate as much people as possible, even with less internet access.
And one resource we know we have is PBS and your local PBS stations. You may want to try pbs.org/parents for a lot of resources for at-home education. Well, that's all the time we have for this segment. And we were talking with education reporter Lee Gaines from WILL's Illinois Newsroom. Also, Peter Medlin, education reporter at WNIJ in DeKalb. We'd also like to thank Ben Leroy, who teaches law at the University of Illinois, and James Lowe, director of the iLearning Center at the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up after the break, we'll revisit our conversation about the benefits of later school start times with a sleep specialist and an Illinois superintendent. I'm Reginald Hardwick. This is The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Getting enough sleep is a challenge for all of us, but it can be especially difficult for teenagers. Up late and up early the next day, a lack of sleep for high schoolers can leave them drowsy, unable to concentrate, anxious, and even depressed. According to the CDC, less than 20% of middle school and high school students start the day after 8:30 a.m., even though research shows that starting school later can make kids healthier, more alert, and even safer. Last year, California became the first state to require later school start times, no earlier than 8 for middle school and 8:30 for high schoolers. Today, we wanted to revisit a conversation that Christine Herman had about this last fall. Unit 5 schools pushed the start time back for their high school and junior high students back in 2016. Christine started by asking McLean County School District Unit 5 Superintendent Mark Daniel what the district was considering when they first decided to delay school start times.
Well, what we were finding was in the research material that there definitely was evidence that students of adolescent years are truly starting to awaken after 8:30 a.m. And our previous schedule had them starting, our high school starting at 7:15 a.m. So therefore, through our research, and we had a parent group that consisted of both community members, students, parents, board members, and we said we need to do something different in our transportation arena for a couple reasons. First of all, we're in a major deficit in regards to that fund, about $1.3 million.
Wow.
And that was the first catalyst to bring this committee together. But because of the research, the scientific research from the various physicians groups, it was quite evident that we needed to do something in regards to our start times.
Yeah, so this was kind of prompted by wanting to save money from the school bus and transportation side of things, but also coupled
correct.
With looking at the research. So
correct.
You said that there was a parent group involved. So was this received well by parents and the community when you finally did make the change?
I think it was probably split. As I had one board member state, this is probably one of the most difficult decisions board members had to make in 40 years. Because it was going against the traditional flow of things, i.e., start elementary first, then you have the second, if they do have siblings, the secondary siblings can then be there after school for those kids. Well, that works. That's true. That does work. But what we had to do then was to address that. We had to address what were the after school programs available for parents so their elementary students could have some place, a safe place to be. So we had to work with our various organizations throughout our community, and we had to expand some within our schools.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about what the sibling dynamics could be there.
Right.
So now, 3 years after this change, do you feel like it's gone well?
I do feel it's gone well, and we did survey our students and our staff the first year of its implementation, and overall, the survey results said students are more engaged, and I'll say it's not just from the secondary students, but also from the elementary students. I would say we probably were starting elementary students 8:30 and running them till 3:30. And our elementary teachers were saying by the time 1 o'clock hit, our little ones, our elementary students were starting to fade. Now they don't see that as much.
Oh, so, that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Greater engagement on the for our pre-K through 5, but also greater engagement for our 6 through 12.
Yeah, and what about from students? I mean, you're talking about kind of parents adjusting to this change. Do the students appreciate it as well?
Well, again, as we surveyed our students as well, our high school students are, I will say, very much appreciative of the change. They had to adjust some of their afternoon co-curricular activities. That was another area we had to work through. It's been, I will say, basically a smooth transition for the co-curricular activities. Also, students were considering, well, what about our work after school? How will that be adjusted? And again, our high school exits at 3:30, so they're on the jobs if they have a part-time job around 4 o'clock. And that's been going smoothly as well. So the concerns that we continue to hear seem to be, yes, there were valid concerns. We treated them as valid concerns. And people made adjustments. And it seems that it's very much embedded now in our everyday life.
So you'll be sticking with it at least for the near future here?
I see us continuing to stick with it, yes. Overall, start times and ending times are beneficial for students, the way that I see our start times today. We've learned how to adjust. It seems to be benefiting our students. And even our teachers are saying, hey, we're seeing this as a plus because of greater engagement.
Yeah. And so do you expect that maybe more school districts across Illinois will adopt later start times for their middle and high school students? Is it something you would encourage other superintendents to consider doing?
I think the evidence is strong in regards to the benefit for the student. So therefore, I would encourage it. I think it is a plus.
Mark Daniel is the superintendent of McLean County Unit 5 School District. Superintendent Daniel, thanks so much for joining us on the 21st.
You're welcome. Best wishes.
And I'd like to introduce someone else. Dr. Jennifer Martin is a member of the board of directors for the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. She's also a professor at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA in California. Dr. Martin, thanks so much for being with us and welcome to the 21st.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me today.
So I think most of us know that sleep is important for us, but we also know it can be hard to get enough. And so back in 2014, the CDC actually labeled sleep deprivation a public health epidemic with over 70 million adults suffering from a sleep disorder. So can you remind us why getting enough sleep is so important?
Getting enough sleep is one of the critical pillars of maintaining health. And across age groups, when people don't get enough sleep, we see a number of health consequences. Specifically, we see changes in metabolism, increased rates of obesity. We see changes in blood pressure. We also see increased risk for problems with mood and mental health problems. We also see increased rates of accidents in people who don't get sufficient sleep. And one of the important things to point out for the context of this topic is that rates of insufficient sleep are actually higher among young people, among students, than it is in adults. So while over a third of adults don't get the sleep that they need, two-thirds of high school students don't get the sleep that they need.
And why is that? Is that primarily there's just so much going on with their schedules, school, work, sports, and other things?
Well, we think that one of the main causes of insufficient sleep in adolescents is a combination of their biological clock being naturally shifted later, so it's a biological difference between children and adults, coupled with very early school start times. So they don't have a lot of control over when they have to get up in the morning and because of school start times. And on the flip side, their brain and body won't fall asleep early enough for them to get the amount of sleep that they need.
Yeah. So generally, how much sleep should children and teens in particular be getting?
Mm-hmm. The recommended sleep duration for teenagers between the ages of 13 and 18 is between 8 to 10 hours. I'm also a parent of a couple of teenagers, and I think, you know, my kids feel pretty good if they can get about, you know, 8.5 to 9 hours of sleep on a regular basis. So there's some individual differences across kids, just like we see some individual differences in adults. But the vast majority of adolescents need between 8 and 10 hours a night.
So Dr. Martin, the 21st and our partner stations reached out to listeners for their thoughts on this. So we heard from Katie in Springfield. She says, quote, my elementary student starts at 9 a.m. My middle schooler starts at 8. I think it should be the other way around. And Melinda from Rockford says that their new elementary school starts at 7:30. Dr. Martin, why do middle and high schoolers need a later start than elementary school students? You mentioned its biological clocks are different. And is that specifically because of puberty and different changes to the circadian rhythm and those things?
That's exactly right. So what happens during adolescence is as adolescents go through puberty, their clock shifts to a later time. So I think one of the challenges that we have is that adults and young children tend to have an earlier internal clock. There's this delay during adolescence, which then kind of comes back to center in adulthood. And, you know, I think one of the challenges to figuring out how to implement later school start times is how to juggle the start times of different schools within a district. And your listener is spot on that just switching those two start times so that the elementary school students start earlier and the middle and high school students start later might be a cost-neutral solution for a lot of districts.
Yeah. And you mentioned the health impacts of not getting enough sleep, but I imagine that very easily translates to school performance and even safety. Do we know, as far as mentally and physically, changing the start time, what difference it can make both mentally and physically? I came across a study in the Journal of Clinical Sleep Medicine that suggested, as you mentioned, the rate of accidents, the car crash rate decreases by 16% due to an hour delay in school starting times. That seems pretty dramatic.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are a couple of major areas where we see benefits. And there was a meta-analysis that looked specifically at sleepiness, which we know high levels of sleepiness are related not only to car accidents, but to other kinds of accidents, but also to school attendance. So, you know, I think kids learn best when they are in the classroom. So that's another area where we see benefit. And we see benefits in terms of mood. So there's a lot of concern now about mental health in adolescents and teenagers. And we know that getting more sleep actually does improve mood. And there's evidence in adults that increasing sleep or improving sleep actually reduces suicidal ideation. And I think this is, again, another area where, you know, we're really concerned about adolescents in terms of their mental health.
Yeah. So, Dr. Martin, we had another listener, Jean from Kewaunee, comment on our post. They said, no time like now to teach responsibility to children, leave it be. Seems to be suggesting that keeping things the way they are will help teach teens like important life skills about getting to bed early or waking up on time. I'm just curious to hear your reaction to that. Like, would it be, is it an important part of discussion to also be talking to teens about getting to bed early?
So two parts to my answer to that question. One is very few of us are trying to teach our 8-year-old to reach the top shelf in the kitchen and try to force them to grow taller than they are. We sort of accept that when they're 8 years old, they can't reach the top shelf in the kitchen. And if they need to be able to reach something, we put it down lower so they can safely get to whatever it is that they want. So the first part of my answer is that we can't expect kids' brains and bodies to be more developed than they actually are. On the flip side of that, I think both parents and kids have a responsibility to protect bedtime. So delaying school start time should not mean that everything else gets later and later and later. So school districts and parents need to set limits on how late, for example, extracurricular activities last. So I think there's really two pieces to that. On the one hand, your listener is correct that bedtime is important, but we can't expect our kids to shift more than they're biologically able in terms of the timing of their sleep.
Yeah, and related to this idea of protecting bedtime, Dr. Martin, if parents or even kids are listening to the show now, whether or not they have the delayed start time, I'm curious to hear what other advice you have for them in order to help kids get better sleep.
I think that having a family culture where sleep is valued, there's a period in the evening when the whole family disengages from technology, is a great idea. We, in our household, we told our kids when they were very young that there was no television available on school nights, and they actually didn't question us for many years.
Yeah.
So, and it was good for the sleep for our whole family, not just for the kids. So setting limits on technology at bedtime is actually a proven strategy to help kids get more sleep. Of course, the challenge is a lot of the kids' school materials are online now, so sometimes one has to be a little bit creative about that. The second thing is, and this is an outcome of delaying school start time, is that kids use less caffeine. But I think parents do need to be aware of caffeine consumption and making sure that their kids aren't having caffeine in the evening, because that can make it a little harder to fall asleep. And the other thing is that there is a point where even when parents and schools do everything right and kids are given a sufficient opportunity to get the sleep that they need, some kids actually have sleep disorders. And if that's the case, if you feel like your kid is in bed for that 8 to 10 hours and they're still not feeling well during the day, it would be really important to reach out to your child's pediatrician and ask for referral to a specialist who can help with your kid's sleep issues.
That was Christine Herman speaking with Dr. Jennifer Martin. She's a member of the board of directors for the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. She is also a professor at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA in California. That's it for today. We're produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Eunice Alpasan is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. I'm Reginald Hardwick. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thank you for listening.